This podcast is sponsored by Rask Invest, Owen's complete guide to money and investing. Visit the Rask Finance website to learn more and join today.
Hello, and thanks for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast, a series exploring the investment philosophies and journeys of some of Australia's leading investors and financial thinkers. I'm Owen Raskovich, founder of the Rask Group. For show notes and other episodes in this series, as well as free educational resources, please visit www.raskfinance.com. Before we go on, it's important to remember the Australian Investors Podcast is provided for educational purposes only and should not be relied upon to make an investment, financial, or taxation decision. The information included in this podcast does not take into account your needs, goals, or objectives, and guests appearing on the show may have a financial interest in some of the products mentioned. Please read all the important disclosure documents and refer to the Rask Group's Financial Services Guide on the Rask Finance website. By the time I was in my early 20s, I had saved up enough money to do something meaningful. According to most of the voices in my life, the obvious and only answer was to buy a house with my money. But having studied and read the books of Buffett, Munger, Lynch, and many others, I had already formed the view that the Australian dream wasn't the most efficient way for me to invest my money. As I was already invested in shares and studying, I was familiar and comfortable looking at balance sheets and cash flow statements of businesses. For me, incoming cash flow was the most important measure. I needed a reliable income stream that was ticking along in the background while I continued to work. So I went online and looked for local businesses for sale, with the idea that I could find a cash flow rich business. I had hoped to use my capital to get a loan, to buy the business, and ideally it would have a spare room that, no matter how grungy it might be, it would double as my office. At first, I focused on businesses with defensive income streams, and then businesses that I didn't need to make a hire for. I looked at laundromats near universities and schools because I was pretty handy with small motors like washing machines and dryers. Then I looked at chicken shops, restaurants, and cafes because, heck, everyone loves a coffee. But ultimately, after going from business to business, I realized that these businesses were incredibly tough. They were competitive, and my time would be consumed by operating them. I also realized that the best businesses were either not for sale or outside of my price range. I wanted higher quality, scalability, and all of those good things for less than a few hundred grand. My guest for this episode of the Australian Investors Podcast is Johnny Wilkinson. Johnny is the co-founder of Equitize, a crowdsourcing platform which allows small investors to buy part of private companies. Traditionally, this quote-unquote pre-IPO industry had been reserved for established venture capital funds, sophisticated investors, and fund managers. Equitize democratizes this market for investors of all sizes and makes its money by taking a small cut from the amount of money raised on its platform. For many reasons, investing in private companies is at the higher risk end of the equity market, so please keep that in mind during this conversation. Having said that, while savvy small company investors often achieve a hit rate of less than 40%, over time they could unearth one or two companies with significant long-term potential. In this conversation, Johnny tells us how he got involved in finance, the genesis of the Australian and Kiwi crowdsourcing industry, how a few beers and an idea with a mate led to him quitting his job and starting a business within 2 months, and why crowdsourcing could have a big future ahead. I hope you enjoy this conversation with Johnny Wilkinson, co-founder of Equitize. Welcome to the show, Johnny.
Thanks for having me.
The traditional way we start with the show is to profile you, your upbringing, see if we can draw some parallels between your experiences prior to becoming a founder and investor, and see how those experiences were borne out over your lifetime and how they shaped you today. So let's go back to the beginning. Let's talk about you as a youngster. Where did you grow up? Did you have any, I suppose, mentors or role models that you pulled from? Some experiences would be great.
Sure. So I was born in Newcastle. Grew up, father was a doctor, mother was a nurse. That evolved into her being a mother and then running the business. So dad had sort of medical practice and commercial buildings alongside of that. I started doing the books at age 12, 13 with mum.
Oh, wow.
So I was sitting there on Quicken, typing things in while she was reading it out. I suppose a lot of things probably helped form who I am today and my interests and ideas around business. On both sides of my family, I come from a line of entrepreneurs. So there is obviously that bug and that in my blood. I can't pinpoint any one thing that led me to my interests or desire to be involved with business. I've just always kind of had an idea and thought that I wanted to be in business and do my own thing. Mm-hmm. You know, I've always been very inquisitive. As a kid, they used to call me 20 questions. I like to understand how things work. That's one of the great parts about what we do. In my everyday role with Equitize is I get to speak to passionate entrepreneurs doing new and exciting things and try and work out how their business operates and, you know, what opportunities there are. So, yeah, look, I had a pretty lucky upbringing in a great family. I went to a good school, went to a decent university and studied economics and finance, which was my view of how to get into the business world.
So you never wanted to become a doctor?
Never wanted to become a doctor, No. I'm one of four kids. None of us ever wanted to become a doctor.
Right.
I've got a bit of a theory about that. It's a combination of kind of how much time doctors spend on call and then how much they make is a pretty strong determinant of whether or not their kids want to become doctors.
Okay, yeah. Okay,
have an interest in medicine and biotechnology, and that's sort of strong in the family. But never wanted to become a doctor. Always interested in business, that sort of thing.
Yeah, because when I was looking, doing some digging on you and Equitize, I noticed that you studied at the University of Sydney. Is that right?
Yeah, went to the University of Sydney, studied economics and finance. Probably didn't attend as much class as I should. You know, was busy. I worked full time effectively while I was at uni. Had lots happening. Involved with, you know, running events and parties and things like that at uni, all that sort of stuff. So, yeah, look, I probably saw university as a bit of a box-ticking exercise. I did meet some great people and learn some very important things. One of the people I met was Chris, my business partner. So, you know, it was very important. I was probably less focused on the study and more on everything else at university brought, which is a good start. I'm funny, I love knowledge, but I hate studying. If you give me a set syllabus or way of learning something, it seems to turn me off. But no, that, you know, curious and love knowledge, always sort of asking questions.
So you're an avid reader perhaps, but not so
I don't get a lot of time to read these days.
I
consume knowledge however possible, but yeah, no, I've only read a few books in the past year. More of my energy goes into running Equitize, but wherever I can interact or you know, consume knowledge or facts or those sorts of things, I always do.
Yeah, it's always an interesting thing, I think, with the guests on this show, is that it's curiosity that drives them forward and ultimately leads them to success, whichever way they go about it. So let's jump from when you finished university. I believe you started at City Investment Bank.
Yep.
And this was around the time of the GFC, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, it was right in the sort of thick of the GFC.
Right. So I'm curious, because there'll be some students that listen to this show. How did you get the job? Because I imagine there wasn't too many opportunities at the time.
No. So funny story goes, I was an intern over the summer. Had expected that I was going to need to go back for a semester. Managed to work it, so I didn't. I was then going to go traveling for the rest of the year. This was right in the thick of the GFC. City wasn't running a graduate program that year, or there was I think two graduates hired in Australia, and they offered me a job in equity markets, which was quite interesting and I was quite keen on. I spoke to a few people that had become sort of mentors or I looked up to and sought advice from at City. And a few of them were, you know, pretty seasoned veterans of finance. And some said, look, I've never seen it this bad before. If you go away for 6-12 months, might not be anything when you come back. Grab the job and go with it.
Yep.
So I did that. Started working straight away. Was working in equity markets. Was doing things in middle office, working with the management, doing client reporting, did a few different things, started trading and operating, and sort of was trying to work my way up, obviously, with GFC and the sort of structural decline of stockbroking and equity markets, the opportunities that I thought weren't really presenting, and the path I was on wasn't going where I'd hoped. So Chris and I, over a few drinks at a mate's birthday dinner, got chatting and knew what was happening in the world around equity crowdfunding and changes in the space, and decided to give it a go.
So he was also in the finance industry for those few years while you were at Citi, right?
Yeah, so Chris had worked at Deloitte in audit and corporate advisory, and had been involved in sort of TMT transactions, that sort of stuff. And then he'd gone and worked for a SaaS startup for a period of time, running their operations.
Okay.
But both of us were sort of at a stage where we were, you know, looking for the next thing. I woke up the next day with a bit of a sore head and wasn't sure if anything would come of it. And then literally 2 or 3 days later, on my Iris feed, something came up saying AWI Ventures looking to make some early stage investments in fintech. And I copied and pasted the article, sent it to Chris and said, mate, this is fate. We've got to do it. So AWI Ventures is now a listed company, InvestSmart. They own some self-managed, self-directed wealth brands. They'd set up an accelerator program to invest in some fintech companies. That is now known as H2 Ventures, run by Ben and Toby Heap. And that's no longer a part of InvestSmart. But they were looking at kicking off an accelerator program in the fintech space.
So I'm interested. So you have this idea over a few drinks. You wake up the next day or a few days later, Chris says to you, like, look at this. And what then? Do you go to AWI and you say, this is our idea? Like, do you have to create a full business plan? I mean, this is a relatively new idea to you.
Yeah, so it was a bit of a pitch deck and a very basic sort of model with numbers, sort of a top-down analysis.
Yep.
So it was predicated off the changes in the legislation and what had happened in the US, and then more relevant was the UK had changed their laws around equity crowdfunding, and it looked as though Australia was going to be following soon thereafter. And working off the fact that, you know, at that stage, there was approximately 500,000 self-managed super funds with an average balance of $1 million. If we took a very small allocation of that, and people saw this as an alternative asset and allocated some funds towards that, then, you know, that's a pretty decent opportunity to channel some investment into some early stage companies in Australia, and potential for some good returns for investors. So, yeah, you know, we had a pretty simple pitch deck and model. We sort of followed a little bit of the lean methodology and presented sort of what we expected, and pitched it to their board after going through a series of questions and interviews and process, and got accepted into the accelerator program.
Wonderful. So do they simply provide working spaces and working capital for you, or did you have to, because I imagine you had a, dare I say, a pretty cushy job at Citi, pretty well paid, I'm guessing, and then you take a step and you take this risk?
Yeah, so so what they do in the accelerator program is they give you 100K, 50K of cash and 50K of services.
Oh, cool.
They set you up, get everything going for the first 6 months, house you, as the name suggests, they accelerate your business. So they provide you with expertise, contacts, help you evolve and iterate your business idea, which is what happened. And then sort of they help you onwards and upwards. So we went through that process. We both quit our jobs, weren't drawing a salary, living off what savings we had, and sort of needed to do that until we then were able to raise some venture capital funding to then sort of grow the business and start paying ourselves a wage.
So it was just the two of you, or was there someone else?
So initially Chris and I, and then we had a technical co-founder, a guy called Panche, who Chris had built a few websites with before. So he helped build the first version of the platform, so we could kind of prove out the business model and get everything up and going.
Yeah, because I was going to say, it seems that the two of you are more of a finance background. In terms of technical knowledge, that's the realm that you two operated in. And what I see today of Equitize is it looks like a quite nimble software or platform business.
Yeah, definitely. It is inherently a technology company. It's an investment platform. And we do have a pretty slick platform that has tech underpinning it all that allows people to electronically identify themselves and invest without interacting with any of us pretty quickly and easily. So it's come a long way. Our CTO Alex is a guru. He's great. And yeah, we've got a good platform and a position where we're really happy, and it can facilitate a lot of investment. And there's more to come. We're always looking to improve and make the experience better for both companies and investors. So we're always trying to change that. But yeah, technology is a huge part of what we do. And without sort of the people that we had help us along the way, Chris and I, without any real technology background, would have struggled, definitely.
Mm. So we've skirted around it a little bit now, but let's go back to that original idea that you and Chris had.
Yeah.
And perhaps you can explain the genesis of Equitize, what it is today, who it serves, and why it solves a problem.
For sure. So Chris and I, a friend of ours, had worked, was one of the sort of founders of AngelList, which is a well-known US venture capital style investment platform.
Mm-hmm.
They help facilitate the venture and angel ecosystem and technology companies sort of hiring in the US, particularly sort of Silicon Valley.
Yep.
So they'd had some great success and really good business that was doing well. So we were aware of that. We both had an interest in sort of high growth companies. I had a bit more of a sort of bent in biotechs. I'd always sort of invested a lot of my personal money into that and had become acutely aware of the Australian venture capital industry and biotech industry were effectively broken. You know, we have some of the best research and development in the world, but we can't commercialize it. A lot of companies will be forced to list on the ASX too early, and then through the course of clinical trials and those sorts of things, have issues getting funding, or their share prices push down, and you know, they have to raise more money at a lower valuation and all these sorts of things. Whereas if you look to the US, most established VC market in the world, you know, they're very effective at funding this sort of stuff, and companies won't list until they're getting towards the final phases of trials and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So I had a bit of a personal bent in that, you know, always very interested in high growth companies doing innovative things. Chris similarly had an interest in the space and had witnessed some of some of the inefficiencies and some of the ways the market was broken, having worked in advisory and that space.
Mm.
So, both of us were quite passionate around the opportunity for channeling investment from everyday investors towards high growth venture capital style investment opportunities that helps obviously underpin growth and employment in the economy and, you know, allows Australia to turn out some exciting companies.
Yeah. So perhaps I can just round that off and just say a small company, presumably doesn't have to be very small, but it could be small, comes to your platform and says, this is our business plan. Mm-hmm. You vet them.
Mm-hmm.
And then on the other side of the platform, you have investors, so retail investors who can invest and take a small slice in that company. Is that right?
Yep.
Yep.
So most of the companies are a little bit more established than just having a business plan.
Yep.
Most of them are operational,
okay.
Have some form of validation. They might not be profitable, but are looking at the next stage of growth and might be raising anywhere from a couple hundred thousand to a few million to really sort of drive their growth. That might be in combination with money from angel investors, some venture capital, friends and family, strategic investors, whoever it might be. But, you know, we're allowing everyday investors the ability to buy shares and have a small stake in these companies.
Yeah, I think an example might work well here. And one of the examples that I have is Booktopia, that you buy and sell books. I've bought many books from them online. Yep. I believe they raised or are raising.
Yeah, so they're currently raising $3 million through us. They are Australia's biggest online book retailer.
Yep.
They bought Angus and Robinson when it was going into liquidation. So yeah, they're an exciting company that's literally grown from a few guys spinning up a website on the side, investing a little bit of money to market it. Now they do $120 million of sales and have grown consistently over the past 5 or 10 years, and look like they have great opportunity to continue to grow. It's a fantastic example of a company that has, you know, a few million people that know and use the brand, want to support it. Most of them are very passionate about this sort of thing. And, you know, if they have the opportunity to invest from $250, you know, it's a great way of allowing everyday investors, you know, the opportunity to invest in companies they believe in. And if the company does well, then hopefully, you know, the investors do well as well.
Mm-hmm. We'll dig into that a little bit more in just a moment. But can you give me an example, a reason why a company such as BookW or just any other company would come to you, and you alluded to this earlier, and come to you instead of going to the ASX directly?
Mm-hmm. So look, listing on the ASX can bring a lot of burden and compliance and costs to companies. A lot of companies might be at a stage of growth where being listed isn't beneficial, you know, particularly if you don't have stable earnings and there's volatility or variance in your model. It can be very hard to be listed, and if people concentrate on results and that's moving up and down, then people find it hard to value companies, and people might not want to hold on to some of those companies. But also the requirements of being listed for a company that should in many cases be really focused on growing the business as quickly as they can is not relevant, not appropriate, and is too much of a distraction. Mm-hmm. So it can be really important that those companies that are trying to grow can access funds without being dragged down or distracted by an IPO, which is a very long, involved and costly process, and, you know, often does take the management away from running the business, which, you know, which can often be at the worst possible time in their growth plans.
Yeah, that makes sense. And obviously, an opportunity for them down in the future, if they are successful, is they can always go and list on the
for sure track. And that's what we encourage, and that's what we're all about. If it's appropriate for a company down the track to list, equity crowdfunding is fantastic because it helps you build a group of investors that ideally will be there when you list, maybe invest some more money at the point you're doing an IPO, and will be there to help support and grow the business. So yeah, look, we are all about helping companies grow and access capital and take the right journey that is fit for them. Some companies might never make sense to list, and if that's the case, then that's fine. We just ensure that that's understood, and company can articulate that to potential investors.
Mm-hmm.
But being listed isn't the only way that investors get returns.
Mm.
A company could be acquired, a company could start paying dividends, or, you know, there's a number of ways that it can happen. So, yeah, we're big believers in encouraging and helping businesses and supporting them to do what's best at that particular point in time.
Mm. Let's circle back to the growth of the business in those early days. You said before that the opportunity was such that the UK and the US had these industries that were growing rapidly. But here in Australia, there were still some legislative issues.
Mm-hmm.
Did you have to go to New Zealand to start the business?
Yeah, so the story goes, Chris and I quit our jobs in 2014, began the Accelerator program. We had the platform underway, and we were not far off being ready to launch. And the process for the changes in legislation had sort of stalled in Australia. Soon after we realised that, we got on a plane and went to New Zealand. We did a tour of the early stage markets, spoke to lawyers, investors, accountants, companies. A lot of people liked the way we were talking of operating, and we saw there was a great opportunity. We'd always had in mind that we'd do Australia and then New Zealand, but given the timing, it made sense to go to New Zealand first. They'd changed their laws in 2013, so we could get you know, licensed and operating pretty quick in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And that's what happened. So after we did our trip, we came back here. We had a board meeting and a couple of advisors that we had around us. At the time, we sort of said it makes sense for us to go to New Zealand, and then made more sense for me to go over and help get things set up and Chris stay here. So I got on a plane and moved to New Zealand for just under 18 months. We got business set up and licensed. We hired a couple guys and sort of got things going in New Zealand, which has been a fantastic way of us establishing the business, growing the user base. You know, we're big believers in the long run, we'll have Aussies investing in Kiwi companies, Kiwis investing in Aussie companies, vice versa. Mm-hmm. You know, culturally, we're very similar and, you know, I think there's great opportunity and there's great companies on both sides of the ditch. New Zealand has some amazing opportunities and some really good people in their tech scene. So, you know, being able to access that from Australia is also a great opportunity.
It's, on the one hand, it makes me a bit, you know, upset that Australia can't move forward with these legislative things as probably as quickly as we would like. But it has changed in recent years. I'm interested with these, when I look at platform businesses, the way I think that there's two sides, there's suppliers or buyers from the buyers and sellers, right? We've got, in your case, we've got the companies who are supplying shares or the opportunity, and then you have the investors who are buying shares, and you're the platform in the middle. Sometimes it can be a bit chicken and egg with platform type businesses. How was it in the early days when you were attracting companies? What were you pitching to them to do?
Yeah, look, I mean, initially it was a bit more Chris and I leveraging our personal and professional networks. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we were doing the analog to the digital of the platform. We were putting people together and that sort of thing. We don't make any apologies and don't try and hide the fact that with equity crowdfunding, globally the stats have kind of played out. It's still roughly 2/3 of funding will come from a company's first, second, third degrees of connection.
Right.
So might be stakeholders, clients, people that, you know, went to school with the founders or, you know, things like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're a very effective marketing and distribution platform for those people to access and be able to invest. It's licensed and regulated, so there's some protection and it happens in a particular fashion that gives people, you know, a level of trust and understanding, and you know we wrap around that, and then the rest of the money comes from the platform and our investors. And early on, that was kind of our network. So we were showing people we knew that might be interested in specific companies, the investment opportunities we had, and broking it a little bit more than what we do now. You know, we still do that. We still look to pick up the phone and call, you know, a particular contact that has an interest in real estate tech if a particular deal comes up, or, you know, something in hospitality or whatever it might be, because leveraging that is also really effective. And then we have the investors who are signed up and ready to go on the platform. We know what they are interested in. So we try and, as best as we can, show people deals that are relevant to them and encourage them to, you know, to interact and if they are interested, invest.
Are there any, I suppose, from a legislative point of view, are there any requirements for the investor, or are there any caps or any issues to deal with like that?
Yeah, sure. So in essence, it all has to happen through a licensed intermediary, which is platform like us, Equitize. So an investor needs to sign up, acknowledge the risk warnings, our sort of terms and conditions, all that usual sort of stuff when you're signing up to any sort of financial service. Then each offer they are shown, there's an offer document, which is effectively like a cut down version of a prospectus or like an IM.
Yep.
And it has some mandated requirements of what needs to be disclosed, and then what other information we think or the company thinks appropriate. And, you know, we like to give investors as much of an understanding as they can of the company. Mm-hmm. So before they invest, they need to acknowledge that they've read and understood that. They understand the risks, acknowledge the risk warning again. And then the only real restriction is they can't invest more than $10,000 into each company every 12 months.
Right. Okay. So you could have multiple companies. It's just you can't go over that limit. Is it? And that's the rule for retail investors, but I imagine yeah. there's slightly different rules for sophisticated or?
So as has always been the case with sophisticated or wholesale investors, ASIC is comfortable that they have the wherewithal and understanding that they can invest whatever they like and they aren't restricted. Mm-hmm. So if you sign up to our platform and provide us with your sophisticated investor certificate or if you're a wholesale investor, you know, proof of that, then you can invest as much as you like in any one offer.
Mm-hmm. I read a stat on your website. I believe the average investment was in a few thousand dollars per investment in a company, but then there was one that I noticed you raised and it looked like there was about $1.7 million raised for the company from about 57 investors. So I imagine there's a few heavy hitters. There's a bit of skew in there.
For sure. Yeah, so we do a number of different types of deals. We do IPOs and quite often we're, putting a small allocation into IPO, trying to encourage the company to get more investors for spread. Mm-hmm. So we've done a few IPOs now. Most recent one was a company called Identity. We got some 250 odd investors into that. We effectively did the retail distribution and worked alongside the brokers on that. So we do everything from that, which is full blown. Anyone can invest. They're not capped on how much they can invest unless we've restricted that to help get the numbers up. Then we also do the public retail equity crowdfunding deals. Then we do wholesale deals, and some of those are private. So, yeah, for instance, sometimes we might have a wholesale deal raising 1.7 and there's 50-odd investors. So across the different deals, the average, I think, is $4,000 to $5,000. On the retail equity crowdfunding, average is $1,000 to $2,000. IPOs, it's about $5,000, maybe a little bit higher. And then on wholesale deals, it can vary. It can be anywhere from 5 to 50, and the average is probably around, call it 15.
As an investor who isn't afraid to go down to small caps on the stock exchange and invest in very niche businesses, I think it's great that these platforms are coming, or your platform has opened up to retail investors, because it gives us that opportunity to perhaps even go even further, or just to invest in businesses that aren't, like you say, held accountable to listing rules or what have you. But I mean, that comes hand in hand with risk, all right? Mm-hmm. So we have to consider our risk tolerances and everything like that. Diversified portfolio, the disclaimer goes on. But from a logistical point of view, if an offer doesn't raise the required amount, mm-hmm. what happens to the money that, say, I would invest?
Sure. So each of the offers we run, we will set a minimum. Mm-hmm. And that is normally related to a minimum overall amount of money that needs to be raised. And that number is normally something that the company's identified and that we've worked with them to get to a position where we're comfortable that getting that money into the business will give them sufficient runway and enough capital to achieve sort of a level of growth, that they're not going to be underfunded and they're not going to be coming back raising money straight away. Mm-hmm. We're going to be putting investors into a company that doesn't raise enough money. So the minimum threshold's set, and if the minimum isn't hit, the money that comes from investors and sits in our statutory trust accounts until the deal closes gets returned.
Okay. I suppose that statutory trust account is important because you want to know where your money's going and who's the custodian of that. Another risk that we have is liquidity, and we touched on it earlier on. A company could have what we call a liquidity event. I could invest in something on the equitized platform, and then in 2 or 3 years that business might be ready to go onto the stock exchange and I could potentially sell my shares or keep holding them. Is there any mechanism, or are you working on anything that perhaps makes that easier to facilitate that liquidity event in the future?
For sure. Look, we think it's important, and to the long-term viability of the market, that will need to evolve. Mm-hmm. If you look to the UK, only 7 years in did they, the two biggest platforms being Crowdcube and Cedars, establish any formal secondary market. Mm-hmm. While we understand, there's certain circumstances and instances where people might need to sell their investment, it isn't a liquid investment.
Yeah.
And you'll often have to take a discount, or the price might be hard to validate if you are trying to sell your shares. Mm-hmm. So we want people to be aware of that as they go in. we will work with the companies, and often, for instance, Zinja uses Boardroom as their share registry. Boardroom does have a facility for the transfer and sale of shares. So there's no lit secondary market, but we do what we can, and where appropriate with companies, encourage them to have a facility that we can help. You know, if we're aware of potential investors, if there's demand, you know, we can put them in touch with the company or that sort of thing. Yeah, look, over time, we will look to have some formal solution for secondary trading, but that in itself is quite quite difficult, quite costly, quite burdensome for everyone involved. So, you know, we're more about trying to encourage people to invest with their eyes wide open and understand, you know, this is a medium-term horizon for many of these companies, and what you might expect when investing in that sort of thing. And as you said before, you know, the potential returns factor in some of this illiquidity and the risks associated with investing in this sort of asset class.
Was when I was on the website, I came across this thing called a syndicate, and syndicate is a fairly common term in the finance realm. But I was interested in this particularly because as an investor, I see what's on the stock market, and we always hear these claims that, you know, that there's fewer stocks on the market, or there's not as many tech stocks down, you know, in the lower end of the market that are high quality. Can you explain what a syndicate is? Perhaps let's imagine we're talking to a beginner and explaining the various parties and why the lead of the syndicate would come to you.
Sure. So in finance, syndicate can mean a lot of different things. In essence, it normally just means a group of investors. On Equitize, we have our syndicates, and all that really is trying to do is encourage your more traditional angel, venture capital, institutional investors to participate on the platform. And the view and hope is that as that occurs and these types of investors become more and more confident, that we will have a lot of deals where there is cross-pollination, and your more institutional or venture capital style investor might be willing to have the crowd invest at the same time. That will happen over time, and has happened as people become more familiar and understand how we work. But syndicates is a way where a lead investor, and they can be an individual, they can be a fund or whatever it might be, can formalize their group of investors and have them invest alongside of the lead investor to round out capital raising. And we do that in a way where we have a structure and a facility that they can have those people grouped into a nominee structure, which makes it easier for the company and the investors, and potentially, as often funds do, they can apply some carry to that vehicle. So benefit that the lead investor might get would be if there's a profit and a return on positive return on investment, that they might take a percentage of that, which is quite common in sort of venture capital, private equity world. Here the 2 and 20, which is 2% fee on the money invested and 20% carry on the profit. So with syndicates, we have a facility whereby an investor can get some carry and use the structure to have people invest alongside.
As we come to the end of this chat, I'm really interested to get your thoughts on where you feel crowdfunding is going in Australia, and also where you think, say, Equitize will be in 5 years.
So look, I think Australia is a great market, particularly for what we do. We have a long history of the ASX being an early stage capital markets, and some really great companies listing and growing and going on being successful. Also with the backdrop of venture capital evolving in Australia and more money being allocated towards it, particularly from super funds and other institutional investors, that has really helped develop the ecosystem, and tech companies and the rest of the market are becoming more efficient at using less capital to grow and potentially have high growth investments and profitable businesses start from very little. I mean, you know, if you look at Atlassian, it's kind of a classic example of a couple of guys in a garage with a credit card started a business that's now worth, you know, billions of dollars. So making early stage capital markets more efficient, channeling and formalizing the ecosystem so that everyday investors and venture capital and angel investors and institutional investors can all invest alongside of each other, and doing that in a structured way like we have with Equitize. So as investors become more understanding and more educated around what equity crowdfunding is and where it sits in your portfolio as an asset allocation strategy, there's a lot of money, particularly in super, self-managed super, that can be directed towards equity crowdfunding. If the ASX continues and there's not a lot of growth in the ASX, potential to invest in some unlisted securities and generate some returns there is obviously a great opportunity in the space. And we look to see that evolve. You know, Australia, as I said, is a great economy, and we do have a good mentality and understanding around investing in all of these companies and supporting things that we want to see succeed. So I think, you know, in Australia, we've got a particularly great opportunity to do that, and equity crowdfunding will help with that. Mm-hmm. Where will Equitize be in 5 years? Hopefully a very significant presence in early stage capital markets in Australia, be one of the leading, if not the leading, equity crowdfunding platforms and investment platforms that helps great companies access funding and allows everyday investors to get exposure to an asset class that traditionally they've been locked out of. Mm-hmm. So, you know, we're just about growing the market, educating people as to where this sits and the great opportunities that there are in equity crowdfunding. And if that works and we succeed, then, you know, we're going to have some great Aussie companies going on to tough it out with the big boys in Silicon Valley, and you know, there'll be some amazing success stories coming out of Australia because the ecosystem will have evolved and more funding is channeled towards great companies.
Mm. Well, we can hope that happens. And let's put some context around it. People can visit the Equitize website for more information on the latest offers. Are you willing to share what the platform raised last year?
We raised approximately $12 million last year, I believe.
Okay. That's great.
From 12 companies. So the retail equity crowdfunding only began last year on the 11th of January with Zinja being our first raise, and they're raising again right now, almost a year to the date. It's exceeded our expectations. It's raised $1 million in 3 days. Mm-hmm. And is onwards and upwards to $5 million, which is the cap on what a company can raise through retail equity crowdfunding in any 12 months. Mm-hmm. So, you know, 2019, those numbers are going to be completely different.
Yeah.
We're expecting something more like 20, 30, 40 companies and, you know, 20, 30, 40 million dollars, hopefully, and keep on growing from there.
Well, I hope I can circle back to this in a few years and look at the success that you've had. So, like I said, people can find out more about Equitize on the website. Is there anywhere else you want to go to find out more about you or the business?
Yeah, look, there's all the information really is on Equitize, www.equitize.com.
Mm-hmm.
And, there's information about who's running the platform, mm-hmm. me, my partner, the team. That's the best way to look at the offers, ask questions, there's a chat function, email us, whatever. There's you know, plenty of different ways to do it. But yeah, go to equitize.com.
Great. I wanted to get your opinion on this just because I think it's important as we talk about this potentially higher risk. Someone goes to your website and they look at these offers. How would you think about personally where these are allocated in your portfolio in terms of the risk and the return profile?
Sure. So this makes up the small percentage of alternative assets you would hold in your portfolio.
Yep.
And traditional portfolio theory would suggest that's anywhere from 5, 10, 15%,
mm-hmm.
Depending on your personal outlook, depending on your horizon and risk tolerance.
Yep.
That could be more. You know, me personally as a young guy with superannuation that I see as my sort of long-term nest egg, a mortgage that hopefully if, you know, Aussie property stays on its long-term trend, will be worth enough in the future, that a lot of my discretionary investment is put towards things like what we have on Equitize. So high-growth companies, many of them unlisted.
Yep.
If you look at endowment funds and some of the big investors in the US, they have up to 50 or 60% invested in venture capital and private equity, those sorts of alternative assets. But no, we would encourage people that, you know, particularly as you're starting out and getting an understanding, this would make up that small allocation to alternative assets. Diversify within what you're investing in. So don't put it all into tech startups doing a particular thing. Mm-hmm. You know, we have anything from neobanks to gin distilleries to online book retailers. So, you know, as you would look at constructing a listed portfolio, make sure that you're not all in the same sector. And yeah, you know, it's an opportunity to slowly build and work out what the right allocation might be for you. We encourage people to get advice and speak to whoever they need to before investing. But yeah, look, that's kind of how I look at it. I put more of an allocation and a weight to it than what most investors probably would, because I'm a bit closer to it, I understand it, and I've got a passion for it. And absolutely, my horizon, you know, is 20 plus years. So, you know, theoretically, I can ride out a lot of bumps between now and then.
For sure. And last question, my favorite. If you could go back in time and tell younger you just one thing about investing, what would it be?
Set rules and stick to them.
Great advice. Johnny, thank you for joining me on the show.
Thanks for having me on.
Thanks again for tuning in to the Australian Investors Podcast. For further episodes, head to www.raskfinance.com. To provide feedback, nominate a guest, or hear from me, you can find me on Twitter with the handle @OwenRask. Cheers to our financial futures.